You're with us for a Wisconsin weekend as we talk corn mazes. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Winding trails, challenging puzzles, abrupt dead ends, spectacular aerial works of art. Maybe you prefer corn mazes with a cause like Govan's Farm in Menominee. The 11-acre maze says your life matters and has the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. What's the best corn maze you've ever been to? What's the most difficult corn maze you've ever done? How long did it take? Join in at 800-642-1234. Corn maze designer Angie Trinan is co-owner of Trinan Farm in Lodi, which is a 15-acre maze design. Angie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, we've had a lot of rain in recent days. How has the flooding impacted your corn maze?
Our maze is kind of muddy. I mean, I think pretty much every corn maze at this point in Wisconsin is going to be, you know, somewhat muddy. But it's, it's still there. You can still wear your boots and head out. So
Boot up and head out.
Yeah, I think Wisconsin people, we can handle it. We can handle, you know, weather. We're good at that.
You've been designing corn mazes a long time, and let's start by talking about your maze design this year, which is cranes. What's the inspiration there?
Well, I'm a veterinarian, and I used to have a lot of biology training and a lot of, different species conservation, that kind of thing. It's always been an interest to me. And a couple things. One is that the International Crane Foundation, which is really interesting, does a really interesting work around the world in preserving cranes and their habitats, is just in Baraboo. It's really close to us, really close to, you know, Madison area. Also, we've got some cranes that nest on our farm every year, and they're just really fascinating birds. And every year we try to find a maze theme that gives us a lot to talk about, a lot that people might be interested in. And there's a lot of sandhill cranes around that, you know, people are kind of familiar with. So that's one of those are the basic reasons that we ended up with cranes as our maze design. They're also beautiful, and that's one of the things I want our mazes to be, is really, you know, visually striking, and with their wings and, you know, just gorgeous, you know, curves of their necks. And it was easy to make the maze look really nice with the cranes as the theme.
Lots of beautiful contours. Take us through the process of designing a maze. How do you make this artistry sculpted into the corn? How does that work?
Well, we start with, you know, what's the design going to be, or what the theme is going to be. And then I sit down, and it's really the most creative part of the process, is where I have to sort of craft that image. And I am a visual artist who works only in the medium of corn mazes, so that's my specialty. I do the design, some sketching to start with, but a lot in Adobe Illustrator as a design program. And then when I'm done with the design, which takes me about a full-time week of really focusing on that, I need the deadline in order to really focus my attention on it. So I start the maze design process when my husband, Alan, plants the corn, like the same day. I'm like, okay, now the clock is ticking, because about 10 days after he plants it, he's going to want the design. So his crew can cut it into the field. So I basically print out the design in kind of a large format paper so they can carry that around with them. I put a grid over the top of the maze pattern on paper. Alan actually plants the cornfield in a grid, so he's got rows going both ways, perpendicular to each other. Then when the corn is just coming out of the ground, you can see the rows really well. And you can kind of see this grid growing in the field.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah. You just take the plan and go out, find a point corresponding to where the trail needs to be on the page, and they mark it on the ground and till out the trails. So, and it grows up.
Does Alan ever mess up? Do you ever have to redo any of the grids?
He calls it taking, like, artistic license. typically, I take my drone up pretty often during the maze cutting process, which helps to kind of catch little errors. But the crew really gets really good at doing things really precisely. Alan says that he wants those trails marked to within 6 inches of where, you know, would be the ideal. So because there's so many trails, that we have to make it really accurate, or the trails won't fit in the field.
We're talking with Corn Maze designer Angie Trinan of Lodi. Do you like to go to corn mazes at night to get a little scared, or do you prefer to stick with daytime corn mazes? Have you ever gotten lost in a maze? How did you find your way out? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Angie, about how long does it take to master your corn maze? How long will people take to get through it?
Well, we try to give people choices because it might be a really gorgeous day and your group is really up for an adventure. So we want to make sure you can spend several hours, like 2, 3, or more hours, investigating all the challenges we have. But we also want people who have a shorter time frame, or they've got young kids with them, or they want to, like, you know, make sure they experience the rest of the farm, to spend 45 minutes to an hour is kind of the initial level of challenge. So people can see how their group is doing and spend quite a bit of time or a little bit less time.
And then there's like a maze within a maze. You have a circle maze.
Well, so our main maze we want to make, you know, fairly challenging, but people come back year after year. And, you know, I had heard from some groups who were really good at it, like, oh, it's not hard enough. Well, you just happen to be really good at it. But then one group, I was just like, listen, okay, fine. Next year I'm going to make a super challenging extra maze. It'll be all circles. The circles tend to be pretty confusing, especially if they're, like, interlocking.
So yeah, because you just you keep walking around in circles. You're going to go mad.
Well, and the other thing is we don't give a map or any, like, clues to, like, how many circles. So you have to be pretty, like, focused and strategic about this. The goal in the circle maze is there's numbers on posts and we throughout the maze. And then we have people go in, find all the numbers, add them up, and bring it back to us. But we don't tell them how many numbers there are or if they're duplicates, and we do place them in kind of a confusing pattern, essentially. So people have to try really hard, which makes them feel really good when they do solve it or come close to solving it.
Do you have people who do end up solving the circle maze?
Some. Again, we don't want to frustrate people to the extent that they don't like it. But people like to be challenged. It's really absorbing, I think, as you come out and are trying to do all these challenges. It kind of helps you forget, like, the rest of your life and your phone and all the things that take our attention. And you have to really pay attention to what you're doing, and also to your group members.
We
encourage people to help each other out, you know, random strangers. Ask them how they're doing it, you know.
Right. It's a team effort. You've been designing these mazes since 2001, long time. Over the years, more than a decade, almost two decades, is there a particular maze that is still your favorite?
Well, in 2010, we did a gecko maze. So the main figure was a gecko. And the rest of the figures had kind of an M.C. Escher-like, you know, feel to them. They were tessellating forms where they would kind of interlock with each other. And there was something called Penrose tilings along the back of a gecko and fractals. So there was a lot of mathematical concepts in that maze. And that was pretty fun. People were really fascinated by that. But also, like, the unicorn maze we had in 2016, I don't know if we'll ever top that theme in the sense of intriguing people, because the title of that maze was Rainbows, Kittens, and Killer Baby Unicorns. So it's kind of like, yeah, I got to go check this out.
We're talking with corn maze designer Angie Trinan is our guide. What is your favorite corn maze in Wisconsin? Have you ever gotten lost? How did you crack it? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more Wisconsin Weekend in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking corn mazes on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For many people, a favorite family fall tradition is getting lost in a corn maze, and getting found again is always good. Are there corn mazes you consider a work of art? Is doing a maze a fall tradition for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. We're touring mazes around the state with Angie Trinan. She's been designing mazes since 2001, and her farm's 15-acre maze is dedicated to cranes this year. Angie, are there haunted corn mazes this year, or corn mazes that people can do at night that we should check out?
Yeah, I would say that most corn mazes around the state have nighttime hours. Probably not all, but many do, because being in a cornfield at night is kind of a unique experience, and it's very different than during the day. It's not necessarily super scary. It's just a little harder to know where you're at, because you only have this like bubble of light right around you to see. Some mazes are haunted, and many farms will have a haunted attraction that is like associated with the maze, but not necessarily in the maze. One thing about having a haunted maze is it has to be kind of designed to be haunted, so that people move through it in a particular way, so they're not so scared that they're crashing through the corn and, you know, knocking things down. So we don't haunt our maze during most of the season. It's really popular at night. It's really fun at night. We do have a zombie event on one night of the year, the Saturday before Halloween. And then we do put people, scary people in the maze in zombie attire. So, but it's a pretty fun, I mean, it's kind of scary, but it's actually mostly fun because we've got a DJ and everybody's dancing, and it's not as scary as I thought it was going to be. But that's awesome.
Well, I would suppose if you're doing a maze at night, you'd need your flashlights. Would be helpful. You'd need some water. Any other provisions when you go out in the corn maze?
Well, this year for sure. Again, your hiking boots or your rain boots. A hiking stick is not a bad idea. There's some slippery spots in most mazes because the trails are always like hard packed dirt. The scale of the maze prevents people from putting in wood chips or paving or anything like that. But yeah, it's good to bring some water. If you want to be what's really helpful is to bring a clipboard and like highlighters, things like that. And some groups will even bring like walkie talkies so they can kind of split up and stay in contact. So that's pretty hilarious. I mean, it's fun.
It sounds pretty serious.
we got people coming back. I'm always talking to people who've been like, yes, we've been here since the beginning or for the last 15 years. And as they come back year after year, they get better and better at it. And bring more friends and, bring a team. It's awesome.
Well, I was looking online, checking out Hidden Trails Corn Maze, and this year they have it dedicated to Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz.
That looks great. I saw that online, too. A really, really interesting design. And you'll see that, like, a lot of mazes will have a theme, and they'll kind of theme activities around it and talk to people about that, and that's part of the experience where, okay, I'm right in the Dorothy maze, and, I've got the lion, and now I'm in the lion's eye.
And then there's a Creek Bed Country Pharmacy in Poinette, and their corn maze has a trivia theme.
So there's different ways that farm owners will set it up so that you can like solve the maze. Most mazes aren't just like, wander in, wander around. We've discovered that like wandering is very fun for about like 10 minutes or, it's most mazes will give you some kind of mission, or like you have to at each intersection or each checkpoint, you have to say, they'll give you like a list of trivia questions sometimes and say, okay, if you think the answer is A, go this way. If you think the answer is B, go that way. Other places will use more technology, and you can use your phone to find the checkpoints. So one of the interesting things about corn mazes and like fall farms in general is everybody puts a different spin on it. Like what is their vision for it? So you'll go to a maze at our place where we have you put the map together like a little puzzle. That's one of your missions. Or you'll go somewhere else and it's more of a checkpoint or QR code or something like that. So you never know what it's going to be.
I'd imagine that you don't get out much in October to explore other corn mazes.
I wish I could. It would be so much fun to just go around, but with hiring a lot of staff and then just kind of running it and field trips and everything, I don't get to leave the farm very often.
There's also Schuster's Farm in Deerfield that has a large and a small maze, so it sounds like it's kind of an overall for any crowd.
Oh, yeah. We know the Schusters. I happen to have gone to college with Teresa just randomly. I'm like, that's weird. We lived in the same dorm, and we ended up having the same job in the area. And their mazes, yeah, they do a really great maze every year and have a lot of really great activities. And that's also in southern Wisconsin here.
We're talking with Angie Trinan. She's co-owner of Trinan Farm in Lodi, and she designs the farm's corn mazes each year, runs the business. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Angie, does having a corn maze in a field change the way you harvest the corn?
Well, most corn mazes, like ours, we plant a slightly different variety of corn than the corn you'll see as you drive out here. We plant a variety that will mature later, so it'll stay green and like the stalk standing up later into the season, so that we don't have it getting really dry and brittle, early in the season. So because we plant our corn in a grid, that makes it fuller in between the trails. It makes the harvesting a little different. It's not the most efficient way to grow corn, but we do harvest and get a decent yield on it in most years.
How do these farm corn mazes and these offshoot businesses to the family farm impact the financials of the farm? How big of a deal is October for your farm?
It's a really big deal. It's our primary income source. Our farm is actually pretty small as farms go. It's like 200 acres, which sounds like a lot, but if you wanted to grow crops or have a dairy farm or something like that, it's really too small to provide a sufficient income just growing traditional farming things. So a lot of farms our size or smaller will think ahead or think about, how can I do something or grow products that I can market directly to visitors, to customers? Because then you have more control over your income. Like if you're selling corn, you really don't have a lot of options other than selling it on whatever price the market has set it, and that can be terrible often. but when you have an agritourism attraction, you have more control. You can do a much better job, and you can attract more people because your offerings are really interesting and people talk about them. So it has that advantage. The only real there's always downsides, but you have to really like people, and you really have to like interacting with large numbers of people, which just takes a mind shift sometimes from traditional farming to what is my operation about. And it's about providing a great experience.
Right. It's a whole different offshoot to running a farm, a whole different business model, even as you bring people, guests onto your property, into your business, and then giving them an experience on the farm.
Yeah. And, we're fortunate in Wisconsin that many of us live so close to areas that are agricultural. So we have an opportunity to visit farms in the fall. Kids have an opportunity to take field trips on a farm. And so I think in Wisconsin, this part of the country, we have more of a connection. We have to actually do get out there and visit the farms. But there's a place pretty near everybody in Wisconsin where you can get out and be on a real farm or be out in the country. And I think that's really great.
Angie, we had an unusually rainy season this year, which delayed corn planting for lots of farmers. Did that affect at all people's experiences in corn mazes this year?
Well, I know that there's at least a couple mazes in Wisconsin that had so much flooding they actually couldn't get the maize in, or they couldn't get it to grow properly. In our own maze, we were a little worried about some areas that were had standing water in them when we were planting and cutting the maize. They resolved, and the corn actually grew just fine. But if that water had remained, corn doesn't doesn't like that. I think, again, most mazes around at this point because of the rainfall are going to be pretty muddy, but the ones who were open early, you know, they're still open. Usually you can just go. Sometimes people will close for active rain, but,
Angie, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's been really fun. Thank you for thanks for thinking of me and come on out to the farm.
That is corn maze designer Angie Trinan and her 15-acre work of art of cranes in Lodi. Coming up, we look at how to use Wisconsin's best fall produce in cooking. What are some of your favorite fall veggies and what's the best way to prepare them? Do you preserve or can your fruit and vegetables? Join in with fall cooking ideas at 800-642-1234. There's more Wisconsin Weekend after this news here on the Ideas Network. We're headed into the kitchen and cooking with the fall harvest on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What's a fall vegetable you've recently tried that inspired your recipes? How do you use root vegetables? What about cranberries? We're at 800-642-1234. James Shend is deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine in Milwaukee, and he joins us from our Milwaukee studios. James, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you have a recipe that makes use of something we know here a little bit in Wisconsin, and that is cranberries. Tell us about your cranberry wild rice pilaf.
What I love about this dish is it's a little bit unexpected. Most people know that Wisconsin is the top grower of cranberries in the country. We do produce a fair amount of wild rice as well as our neighbors in Minnesota. And so this is a great way to combine both of those dishes. It's a great fall dish to have, but it's also really elegant enough that you can put it on your Thanksgiving or holiday table, and it just fits right in. Real easy to make. It's only about 7 ingredients, so it's something you can put together really, really fast.
But wild rice can be tricky.
It can be. You just have to cook it low and slow and very gentle, and it usually turns out really, really well. You just need that time. It's nothing that you're going to do really quickly. So you just have to plan for it. Like, this bakes in the oven for about an hour, and so you just have to plan accordingly.
When do the cranberries go in?
Cranberries go in right at the beginning.
Okay.
And so we just toss everything in, pour it into a baking dish, and then just the cranberries go in right at the end.
Oh,
okay. I take it back. I am corrected. It's a little early in the morning
here. That's okay. And so you actually end up baking this pilaf in the oven. Is that more like finishing it off?
Yeah, so it's the last step you're going to do. You're going to add cranberries and almonds to it just before you serve it. And so the cranberries don't need a whole lot of time to heat up. We're using dried cranberries in this particular dish, but there's a lot of great things you can do with fresh cranberries.
We're looking at recipes here, and this one is for the cranberry pilaf, which is at WPR.org/mornings. James, what produce do we have here in Wisconsin that we should really make use of as the temperatures cool off?
Well, the fall is the great time of year for a lot of the harder squashes, so things like butternut squash, acorn squash. They're all coming into season, and they're the ones that you should be looking for. You're going to start to see tomatoes dwindling really quickly now, but you can still get some good ones. And the zucchinis and stuff, they're probably all gone. So we're going to be looking at a lot of the squashes, a lot of produce like apples, pears, that are common right about now. So those are the ones that you should be seeking out, and they're the absolute freshest and best tasting you can look for.
What do you like to do with your squash?
Pretty much anything. The simplest technique that I like to do is just peel a butternut squash, slice it up, and then just toss it with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and roast it. And it's as simple as that. And it just takes a couple of minutes to do, so maybe about 30 minutes in the oven to get tender, depending on how thin you slice it.
Well, let's take a call. Chris is joining us from Adams. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I have this fabulous recipe. The first thing you do is you make a cranberry relish, and this is based pretty much on Susan Stamberg's that she puts on the air every year. They make her come back to put this on the air. But it's basically you saute some garlic and onions in the bottom of a pan, and then you throw in a can of frozen condensed pineapple orange juice, and then put in a bag of fresh cranberries. And then when that's all cooked up, you throw in like a handful of fresh ginger and a handful of horseradish. And I like to put in as much horseradish as I can tolerate. And you can jar this up and keep it either. You can either can it or you can put it in your freezer for the winter. But the recipe is you saute some more onions and garlic in the bottom of a pan. And then you put in about 2 cups of dry sherry and a bunch of wild rice. And then you make a trivet. You quarter an onion and put it in there, and you slice some sweet potatoes, like really thick, and put those in. And then you put chicken on top of that, whatever you want to use. I usually use thighs, but you can do that skin side up. And you put that in the oven and bake it at like 325 until the chicken is done. And then when that's all done, you put the cranberry relish on top of it, stick it under the broiler,
so
and caramelize it a little bit. You got to watch it at this point because it'll burn. But you caramelize it a little bit, and it's absolutely delicious.
Oh, Chris,
that sounds
absolutely amazing. And she's using like everything from the fall harvest. I mean,
exactly.
I'm just ticking it off my list here. Chris, thank you so much. James, what do you love to use ginger for? Where do you use ginger in your cooking?
Oh, just about anywhere. I mean, that's one of those ingredients that straddles everything from desserts to appetizers and anything in between. It's you see it commonly in a lot of desserts like gingerbread and things like that this time of year. But it's great in like stews and chilies and chutneys. And it's great fresh, dried, powdered, you name it. It's a wonderful ingredient. I like to use it. A little bit of it goes a really long way. And like the easiest, simplest thing you can do is just slice just one or two slices from it and drop it in a glass of hot water. I mean, very simple for a quick tea. But you can also put it into oatmeal, which I do pretty much every morning, fresh or dried. And it's just one of those great ingredients that goes with almost absolutely everything.
So along with your ginger in your oatmeal, I have to ask, what else is in that oatmeal?
So well, this time of year, I'm usually tossing in some cranberries because you can find those fresh cranberries now, and I'll cook them up with the oatmeal because I usually do the Irish oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does take a little bit longer to cook. So about halfway through, I'll toss in about a handful of fresh cranberries, and they'll have enough time to cook and almost pop and explode a little bit. And so it flavors the whole thing. A little bit of fresh ginger, maybe a touch of cinnamon if you got it. So that's one of those things. And always some toasted nuts, usually pecans.
And does your oatmeal keep? What do you do with the leftovers?
Oh, so I usually make a big batch like on the Sunday, and then I'll put it all into one container, bring it to work, and then I'll be eating from that, just microwave it for about a minute or so, and it holds beautifully.
And then you have food for the whole week.
Exactly.
James Shend is with us. He's deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine. It's based out of Milwaukee. Where do you go to find quality vegetables here in Wisconsin? Where do you find the freshest stuff? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Sarah now, joining us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. Well, I just wanted to mention the noble turnip because I like turnips a lot, and I discovered this recipe in a Jacques Pepin cookbook and for sweet potato soup, and it had turnips also, and you couldn't even really notice that there were turnips in it, but it just made the soup a lot more interesting, and I think there was like chicken broth and shallots and.
But the turnips were in there, but in slightly disguised. Sarah?
I don't know if you say disguise, but they were just, when you ate it, you didn't think, oh, turnip soup.
You didn't think of turnip soup. James, you know, she calls it the noble turnip.
The noble turnip. I love that term. And to me, the turnip, the rutabaga, the parsnip, those are all those, what I would call noble or grandma heirloom vegetables. They're awesome vegetables that a lot of people just kind of discount. They're not the real popular ones, and to me, those are the ones that you should be seeking out. What I found fascinating last year is I went to a number of restaurants in Milwaukee, in Madison, and kind of across the country, and was kept seeing parsnips. Parsnips were everywhere, and a lot of people were doing very, very interesting things. One of the ones that I saw that was very intriguing was a tempura battered and then fried parsnip. And I'm like, this is a great way to elevate what those more mild vegetables are, and something that you can pick up pretty inexpensively. And as Sarah mentioned, the turnip kind of is one of those background flavors. You don't really notice it a lot. It's great to kind of mix into like mashed potatoes. So just dice them up with your regular potatoes, put them in the simmering water, and then mash it all up. And you don't really even know that they're there, but you're hiding in one of those vegetables.
And you're hiding also in some, you know, some extra nutrients as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
So where do you go to find all of your fresh fall produce? Where do you like to find it?
Right now, it's everywhere. That's what I love about this. There's a lot of great farmers markets still going on, and so you can find those. I just did a quick search, and I'm finding great farmers markets everywhere from Rhinelander down to Kenosha. So there's a lot of places you can go right around where I'm down in Kenosha right now. But there's a lot of orchards that are popping up they're established, but they have produce stands now in them. And so you can go and have the fun and go to the corn maze and do the apple picking and things. But they also are providing a lot of fresh produce this time of year. So those are great places to go. So just keep checking your local areas.
So when you pick out produce, do you look at the size? How do you evaluate the quality of it?
So I'm one of these people that tends to gravitate towards the imperfect or ugly produce just because I know that it's still a good quality piece of fruit or vegetable, and it doesn't usually cost as much. And it's like if you go to a grocery store, they usually push those off to a side, or a farmer's market. You can kind of get the dented, dinged kind of discount on those, but they're still really good, high-quality products, and you're not looking for those beautiful, the perfect magazine quality looking of an apple.
We're in the kitchen preparing dishes inspired from the fall harvest with Taste of Home Deputy Editor John Shend. He's our guide. Maybe you've connected with a farm through a CSA and you have a box of winter squash and beets, potatoes, leeks that you want to know what to do with. Join in for your recipe ideas, 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more Wisconsin Weekend in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're in the kitchen for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And as the days get shorter, we're getting some recipe ideas for meals with our fall harvest produce all around us. Classic way to prepare root vegetables is to roast them in the oven with olive oil and salt, but you might have better ideas for beets and onions. Let's talk about your favorite recipe ideas. 800-642-1234. James Shen stays with us. He's deputy editor at Taste of Home. Let's go to Dan now, joining us from Cascade, Iowa. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What are you doing with your cherries, may I ask?
Well, my wife and I enjoy planting various things, and we do it mostly by, oh, that plant looks neat. So we saw this ground cherry plant, and we thought, well, that's cool. So we planted that, and we have all these ground cherries, and I have no clue what to do with them. And I opened up one of the fruits, and I looked at it, and didn't look like much to me. I tossed it on the ground, and our chickens pecked it, and they walked away. So I'm like, well, that's, I don't know if that's a clue or something. Are these things edible?
James, what would you do with those ground cherries?
Oh, I mean, they're fascinating. I love just eating them. I mean, it's something that it's one of those things you don't normally see. So it's something that you're going to have to find either growing wild or you intentionally plant because it is cool looking. And honestly, I have not done a whole lot with them. I've had them a couple of times just fresh. You can puree them. One of the things that popped to mind immediately was like a salsa. Just make like a fruit salsa, just chop them up and things like that. I've seen them in pies and try them with an appetizer, like a goat cheese, just sliced fresh, or you could even do a quick pickle. So just take out the seeds, chop them up very coarsely in big chunks is what I kind of like to do, and then heat up like a sweeter vinegar, like a red wine vinegar or even a champagne vinegar, maybe a little bit of spice in there, like cinnamon or cloves, even a pumpkin pie spice, and then just quickly pour it over the cherries and then just let it sit for about 10 minutes and you're good to go. And then just match it up with like a nice fresh Wisconsin goat cheese or nice cheddar.
Dan, how does that sound?
Awesome. That sounds great. Right up my alley. I like simple things like that.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for calling in.
Produce.
Yeah, and James, you know, let's look at Brussels sprouts here for a moment. You know, I usually just go with putting them with some olive oil and kosher salt. But what can we do with your Brussels sprout recipe?
Well, I love Brussels sprouts. This is one of those vegetables that we never had growing up as a kid because my mother hated them, so we never actually saw them. And so when I first discovered them, I was like 22, and I'm like, this is a fascinating vegetable. And one of the things that I really, really love to do is just take them, cut them in half, and then shred them. So you just chop them really, really finely. And then I'll throw them into a hot wok or a cast iron skillet that has no oil in it whatsoever, just a dry skillet, and then cook them for a couple of minutes. And I'm looking to get a little bit of a char on there, and then I'll add some olive oil or sesame oil, salt, pepper, garlic, whatever you really want to throw in there is great, even dried cranberries or fresh cranberries if you want. And it's a very quick dish. It comes together in about 5 minutes, and it's so, so good.
We have a recipe for your shredded ginger Brussels sprouts as well on our page. You know, it sounds like a little bit as you experiment that you're able to kind of come up with a different taste each time you try these recipes with fall vegetables.
Exactly. And I mean, that's what I love about that Brussels sprout recipe is I don't make it the same way twice. When I put it in the magazine a couple of years ago, I'm like, I actually had to write something down and put it in there. And so we ended up with the ginger. But I do that every conceivable way. There's nuts that go in it sometimes. Sometimes I'll add in some shredded like butternut squash. It's a very versatile thing.
And putting it in a dry skillet, too, you know, that's kind of different as well. Nothing is weighing it down.
Exactly. It's a classic Asian cooking technique. You want to kind of get a little bit of a char first. And as long as you keep stirring it, you're good to go. And then the oil is actually going to be a flavor carrier. It's not going to help or not stick to the pan, but it's going to be more for the flavor.
Well, James, this has been fun. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
James Shund is deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine, and he joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. And we have recipes for the cranberry wild rice pilaf and that shredded gingered Brussels sprouts that I want to try tonight. Other recipes as well at WPR.org/mornings. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic food stand in southwest Wisconsin.
Pete's Hamburger Stand in Prairie du Chien hit a milestone this year, 110 years in business. Not only have multiple generations of families been enjoying these burgers on the weekends for more than a century, but generations of Pete's descendants have been flipping burgers, grilling onions, and running the stand during that time. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently visited Pete's to find out what makes the burgers so special.
All right, and two burgers and a drink will be $10.25.
When you step up to order at Pete's Hamburger Stand, you'll notice there's only four things on the menu. soda, water, chips, and a hamburger.
Have a nice day.
You too.
Hi.
And the recipe is simple. Quality ground beef, onions, a little salt. Oh, and water? For generations, regulars have been lining up for their beloved hamburgers at Pete's. Just listen to a few of them.
They're good.
Kind of like a White Castle, but a bigger White Castle. Definitely more meat. It's good. Love them.
They're unique and different and healthy.
Nobody can beat them.
Try it once.
The stand in downtown Prairie du Chien looks like it's straight out of the 1920s. It's tiny, with green and white awning and sliding windows you walk up to place your order. And inside is Pete's granddaughter, cooking the burgers exactly the way he did more than a century ago.
My name is Mary Hoosier. I am the granddaughter of Pete Gokey, the founder of Pete's Hamburger Stand. We're 110 years old this season.
Locals say it's the best burger around. On the day I stopped by, almost as soon as the sign flipped to open, there was a line. So what keeps people coming back?
The water keeps the burgers nice and moist. Our pan doesn't have a drain in it, so we don't clean it till the end of the day. We just keep adding water and onions and meat all day, and it just makes for a good recipe.
Mary's husband, Bill Hoosier, also cooks at the stand. He says each burger leaves behind a little more flavor as it cooks.
It gets better. A lot of people won't eat off the first pan. They claim it doesn't taste as good. So.
Before Pete's became a permanent stand in the 1920s, the original Pete, who was also a volunteer firefighter, sold his burgers from a cart at festivals and fairs. He noticed the burgers stayed juicy when he cooked them in water as the customers ebbed and flowed. The recipe hasn't changed since.
What? Onions on it? Nope? Okay.
Today, the stand, which is open Friday through Sunday, goes through a couple hundred pounds of meat each day and up to 500 pounds of onions over the weekend. Mary cooks anywhere from 55 to 65 burgers at a time. And while that might sound like a lot, they were gone in a flash the day I visited.
What's it like to be cooking hamburgers when you see that long?
Well, on some days, it's all right if the weather is cool. On hot days, it can be very exhausting. By the end of your shift, you are ready to go home.
But Mary and Bill say there's something special about having to wait in line to get your burger.
Coming to a stand like this where you have to wait probably, and it's something most people are not used to, or not anymore at least, and it's kind of nostalgic, and people talk in line when they're standing waiting, and it's amazing the connections that they can find, you know, between people that are usually strangers, and sometimes they aren't when they leave here, so that's kind of neat.
The Hoosiers are big on community, not only in how they source their products with local meat and buns, but they also donate all proceeds from their bag chip sales to people in the community fighting cancer. Bill and Mary say hard work, perseverance, and a quality product are what have kept the business going for so long. As for what the original Pete might think about making it 110 years,
I think he'd be very proud of his children and grandchildren.
So whether you like your burgers with onions or without, just don't ask for cheese. The Hoosiers hope you'll enjoy the burgers and meet some new friends along the way.
Well, I just hope that they come here and they get their money's worth. You know, they feel that they've gotten the product that's worth what they've paid for, and they've gotten good service. And hopefully along the way, the environment added to it just makes it fun, even if you have to stand in line.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy is a digital content producer and brought us that story on Pete's Hamburgers, which has been open in Prairie du Chien for 110 years. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition here of Wisconsin Weekend on The Morning Show. What's happening in your part of the state that could reach all corners of Wisconsin? Give us a tip at Wisconsin Weekend and Mornings at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.